In the UK, 2.3 million people use food banks, including 6% of children and 3% of adults. There's been a rise year on year. Is the rise in access to food banks just an issue, or is this a much bigger societal issue, such as a shrinking of welfare support from the British state? Welcome to Debt Talk Podcast with me as your host, Rippon Ray. You may have guessed it, I am shamelessly, yes, shamelessly speaking about food banks and welfare state. To navigate this month's podcast, which is no doubt going to haunt the current government, I have Helen Barnard from Trussell Trust and Dan White from Disability Rights UK and author, and finally Glyn Robbins, senior lecturer and visiting fellow of the London School of Economics. So my panelists, who are also campaigners in their own right, will also give Debt Talk listeners top tips on how to organize campaigns to address food poverty and inequality in our communities in the UK. So let me start with Helen Barnard from Trussell Trust. Helen, before we dive into the subject, can you provide a bit more meat on the 2.3 million people, which I plucked out of Trussell Trust's database? What does that mean in a civilized nation such as the UK?
Well, there's actually a wider group of people that we should be worrying about, because what we know is that for most people who are facing hunger and severe hardship, they don't actually turn to a food bank because people put it off as long as they can, because people don't want to have to turn to charity for something as essential as food. So actually, when we did some research looking at that wider group of people who are facing hunger and hardship, we found it's actually about 9.3 million people, including 3 million children. So that is about one in five children growing up in a family facing such severe hardship that they are really struggling to afford essentials. And of course, it's one of those you don't get to redo your childhood. You don't get to kind of try again later. And the research we've done has shown the damage it does to individuals, to families, to people's futures, to be facing that kind of hardship is appalling from a kind of moral and ethical point of view, actually also from an economic point of view. So just last week we published research, we found that the level of hardship we're seeing is costing the country about £75 billion in higher spending on public services to try and remedy the damage that's being done to people not being able to get into work because of that hardship and lost tax revenues and lost earnings. So it is a fundamental problem in our society and for our economy.
In your lifetime, you have noticed the change of it to communities that you're offering food packages. What are they saying?
We are in danger of thinking it is normal to have a food bank in every town. And actually, we don't have to go back that far. 15 years ago, we didn't have a kind of mass distribution of emergency food across the country. You might have had a local vicar would have had a bag of food in their office. Every now and then someone knocks on the door, someone's kind of fallen between the cracks of the system, and they need a bit of a helping hand. What we're now seeing is millions of people not able to afford essentials, and quite often not only for a short period, but for quite long periods of time. And I think that's been about two things. One is the erosion of the social security system, the kind of series of cuts and freezes, which mean once you do get access to it, which is not easy, the actual amount of money you get is so far below the cost of essentials, it doesn't protect you from really severe hardship. But then also the cost and insecurity in the labour market. So work is no longer a protection necessarily, particularly low-paid, insecure work. In the housing market, people are stuck in the private rented sector with really high rents, which mean they can't necessarily afford food as well, and the constant threat of homelessness. And you've got things like the high costs of energy, all of which kind of pile on top of people and leave them in this position of just not being able to afford essentials.
When we speak about food poverty, since this is what your organization pretty much focuses upon, what do we actually mean? What is food poverty?
So we don't use the phrase food poverty because it feels like it can become a distraction. It's just poverty. If people can't afford food, by and large, they also can't afford a whole range of other essentials. They're behind with bills, they're missing out on all sorts of essential goods and services. And there is, I think, sometimes a risk if we badge things as food poverty, we think the answer is food. Whereas hunger in this country is not a food problem at all, it's an income problem. People do not have the money in their pocket to cover bills and essentials. And that's what we have to focus on. That's where the solution lies.
You've briefly covered it, but when you have a situation where 6% of UK's children are relying on food bank, what does that actually say to state's obligation on children's welfare?
I think it's a kind of damning indictment, I think, on us as a country, that we are failing to protect children from growing up in this hardship. And I know we're going to be talking about this. The other group who really bear the brunt of this is disabled people. So when we look at Trussell Trust food banks, about two-thirds of people, more than two-thirds actually, who come to us are disabled or live with someone who is. And what we're finding is the systems that should protect all of us, when you have a rough patch, you should be able to rely on Social Security to kind of help you keep your head above water. They are just utterly failing. And charities like us are having to pick up the pieces, but we are not the right solution. You know, we are not a good solution to hunger or to poverty. And we don't believe in a, you know, compassionate, just society as wealthy as ours. Food banks should exist at all.
You briefly covered about disabled people, but breaking down the figure, what percentage of groups are you getting?
So when we look at people who are turning to Trussell food banks, you see about two-thirds of our support is going to families with children. And that is, I mean, a whole range, but particularly families with three or more children are especially at risk, and families with younger children. And just the research I mentioned earlier, where we looked at that wider group of people facing hunger and hardship, the group with the highest risk is the under fours. So it is babies and toddlers and very young children at highest risk of this situation. And then the other group are disabled people and carers. And we actually did some research a few weeks ago, specifically with people who are getting universal credit and disability benefits. And it was really shocking. More than three quarters of people have gone without essentials in the last 6 months. And about 4 in 10 are already skipping meals to try and keep up with other essential costs. And that is before we get some of the record cuts to disability support that the government announced recently. So, you know, people really are living with just unacceptably high levels of hardship. And you have no way out. When you talk to people, people feel stuck, they feel trapped, they feel there is no light at the end of the tunnel for them. And the impact of that on your mental health as well as your physical health is really, really appalling.
Apart from counting the numbers of people coming through also through Russell Truss's doors and providing packages, what else is the, I suppose, the, from a campaigning perspective, you're doing to highlight such a scandal?
So we do a number of things. So we do research not just into the scale and the nature, but the drivers of food bank need. So if we understand why people are having to go to food banks, we then do the next thing, which say, okay, what are the policy solutions? And we have been able to come up with a whole range of steps that the UK government, devolved governments, local government could be taking to change this. We then also work with our supporters, with lived experience partners, with our food bank network, to build the kind of public pressure. So, for instance, when the disability cuts started to be talked about, we were able to kind of reach out and galvanise our supporters, people in food banks, to write to their MPs, to raise their voices, to say this is not what we want to happen. And also to work with people with direct experience of hunger and hardship to create those solutions. Because if we do that, we have much higher confidence that they will work if they are created with the people who have that direct experience. And also on the ground, I mean, it's worth saying, so Trussell food banks, the vast majority now, they're not just doing food parcels. They will have a financial inclusion person in the food bank to help people with benefits, with debt. They will be signposting and connecting people to other local services. So trying to, again, get at the drivers. Why did someone reach the crisis that led them to a food bank? And then actually what a lot of the food banks are now doing is actually going upstream locally, talking to their referral partners to say, look, people are reaching us having not had any of this debt advice, benefit advice, housing advice. But you are all organisations that have referred them to us, but you should be giving the support earlier. And then they would never have reached this point. So trying to do that work locally to kind of intervene earlier so people don't have to reach that awful kind of pitch of hardship before they get the help they should be getting.
Moving on to, I guess, the current government, do you feel the current government is listening or doing anything at all, since many argue that the focus has been on how the previous governments left the finances so bad, and the current local election result actually shows otherwise, and there seem to be very few innovative measures to reduce poverty coming from the current government? And is that a fair comment to make?
We have seen quite a lot of good steps, actually. So if we can, it seems like a long time ago, if we go back to the King's Speech, when the new government laid out what legislation they were going to pass, two of the really major things in it was legislation to improve workers' rights, so that people doing insecure jobs would have a more reliable income, essentially, and more protection. And that, you know, and they are taking that through. So far, it seems they're keeping it pretty robust, which is what we wanted, to try and make work a more reliable route out of hunger and hardship. They also have brought forward a bill which is about private renters' rights, so to try and improve the security people have when they're privately renting, so they can't just be kicked out for no reason at 2 months' notice. And again, so far, they seem to be doing fairly well at keeping that as a kind of robust piece of legislation with some teeth. So we were really, those were two of the things we had asked for. So we were pleased to see those. We've also seen the first step they took in their very first budget was on universal credit, was to reduce the amount of money that can be taken off your benefits to pay back debt. And again, that was something we had asked them to do very early that they'd done. And the other thing is the Household Support Fund, which funds crisis, local crisis services across England. We've had these kind of endless 6 month extensions. What we said to them when they came in was, you have to extend it again because it was due to expire. So they extended it again, but we need a long term replacement. And we've been working on what that should look like. I think we are, you never know, but I'm hopeful that they will bring forward a long term replacement. So there's been quite a lot of positive. I think the thing now, though, the thing that has just been incredibly disappointing has been to see the Treasury, because it is coming from the Treasury, driving forward these record cuts to disability benefits, which will be absolutely devastating and are completely counterproductive, because everything they've talked about revamping employment support, has actually been really, really positive. They've said lots of what we all wanted to say, to see, about kind of localising employment support, making it about positive help rather than sanctions, linking up with health services, all this stuff is great. But they have completely undermined that if they are going to massively cut the incomes of a group of people who are already three times more likely to face hunger. So that has been, I think, just a bit of a landmine in amongst the kind of positive signs. And then suddenly you drop these enormous cuts to disability benefits, and it kicks the legs out of that, all that positive agenda, which the Department for Work and Pensions had been trying to pursue.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you. Let me get Dan White from Disability Rights UK into the conversation. Dan, you've heard what Helen said. Also, speaking of the current government's measures of disabilities, what is your take on this issue? And would that obviously increase the number of people visiting food banks even more?
This government have picked up the ignorant reins of the previous government on benefits and sadly decided to emulate and go harder and faster on the cuts. It is absolutely the wrong path to take morally and ethically. We know from data that the Office for Budget Responsibility estimates that the number of people who will lose the PIP daily living component is 800,000. So this amounts to a minimum of 4,200 per year. And just to clarify, the daily living component is designed to assist individuals who require help with everyday tasks due to a long-term health condition or disability, activities such as preparing food, washing, dressing, etc. So losing money when work is not an option equates to poverty. We already know that to live with a disability means needing an extra £1,000 a month just to have the same living standards as non-disabled people. So less money will mean less food. Already we know, thanks to the brilliant Trussell Trust, that 6 out of 10 people using food banks have a disability, and no doubt Trussell Trust expect that number to increase significantly this year onwards. Food banks, though, as great as they are, cannot cater specifically for disabled people who have, in some cases, specific diets. This isn't their fault at all. I just want to clarify that. So, however, those forced into food banks will only increase their chances of ill health by not eating correctly. And then, of course, we will see the NHS and the already decimated social care system pick up the tab from this. So it seems to be a very cruel Morbius strip from benefits to poverty, just going round in the circle and getting faster and spinning faster.
Let me bring disability, poverty and welfare state within a wider context. Can you explain, Dan, how we managed to get welfare support to communities impacted by disability within a historical context?
Absolutely. Well, as we know, the UK's welfare state was funded after World War II with the aim to provide a comprehensive system of social insurance from cradle to grave. Not, you know, that would mean everybody in the country would be taken care of from the time of their birth until their death. The protection funded through national insurance contributions may be all working people. So it was held up as a principle of social justice. So for disabled people, the welfare system was created to provide a financial safety net, the level of support such that disabled people can live independent lives. As I said, as living with a disability costs more because of things like purchasing specialist equipment, paying for more social care, and et cetera, et cetera. All these things that need purchasing, and disabled people also live under what we call the social model of disability, which is the understanding that disability is something created by society. This is because disabled people face barriers that stop them from taking part in greater society in the same way as non-disabled people. Physical barriers, for instance, that disabled people face, like accessing shops, healthcare, social activities, transport, employment. So this means there is a need for financial aid to support people excluded by the design of greater society. Disability benefits were created to support and give income to those who, through no fault of their own, generally and deservedly need it. And it's just such a social tragedy to see this government emulate the previous government by attempting to chip away that support with no structured long-term plan.
What is the current poverty level among communities impacted by disability in education and employment?
Education has always been another area of restricted investment for young disabled people. Even now, SEN education, a special educational needs education, is suffering, even in the face of government insistence of change. So many disabled children are not receiving their education, health and care plans, or even getting transport provided to their designated colleges or schools. Bankrupt local councils are trying to wriggle out of responsibility on this as funding from central government lapses. Even the local government association in a report said that the lack of funding from central government will mean older and disabled people struggling to access vital care. There will be less support for families in crisis. And of course, cuts to vital bus and home to school transport routes. This will leave children without access to vital special educational needs provision. So, lack of an education for young disabled children means as they grow, they do not possess the skills and education promised to seek employment. They will, in a horrible catch-22 situation under the current benefit cut announcements, they will probably be punished for not being employment in the future due to them not having the education in the first place. It's staggering incompetence from the system. And turning to employment, the government has this, it seems, fairy tale vision of cuts, forcing people into employment. We know the Access to Work scheme, which already has a huge backlog, is getting no more funding. And we know the disability pay gap is near 18%, which means disabled employees are paid less per hour than their non-disabled colleagues. Employment is not a direct route out of poverty. Give the employers the tools, invest in all children's futures and pay what is fair. And then perhaps you will see a sea change and a better impact in everyone's lives.
I mean, I might as well be blunt about this, and I might as well hear it from you. Do you think the current landscape is getting worse?
Oh, my landscape is getting absolutely worse, much worse. Food and energy poverty is rising. My inbox is on the point of collapse, sadly. Amnesty International, the UN Special Rapporteur on Poverty, whom I met only a couple of weeks ago, the Trussell Trust, and even Human Rights Watch are braced from the fallout from this recent benefit announcement and are ready to respond to the maximum. Not one organisation or group that I work with or speak to thinks that cutting support to the marginalised is the human thing to do. There are better and more humane options to grow an economy. Historically, disabled people and indeed unpaid carers have always felt the swish of the blade of government cuts. It has a lot to do with being voiceless. Yes, but sadly, we live in a society where your value as a human being is quantified by how much you can produce for profit. And because many disabled people carers do not fit into this category because they are too busy just trying to survive, they are seen as having no economic worth. Sad, but unfortunately, very true. We need to support people who need it, not blame them for living lives that they have no choice in living.
Dan, initially the target was pensioners, if you remember, and now the disabled communities. Do we just accept that issues related to humanity and caring for the vulnerable or just not worth doing since either Conservative or Labour seem to be seen not caring?
Well, absolutely, we don't accept it. I can imagine everyone here does not accept it. As a society, we have lost a great deal of who we are. Sacrificing the elderly and the vulnerable to the altar of money and greed has to end. Blaming those who need extra support to live is abhorrent. Taking away from those who already have very little or nothing is just state-sponsored ignorance and cruelty. We have the data and the facts that people will be pushed deeper into poverty because of benefit cuts. The Department for Work and Pensions says it expects 150,000 people will no longer qualify for carers allowance or universal credit's own carer element top-up because of these welfare reforms. How is this growing an economy? How are we allowing this catastrophe to happen? We need dialogue. We need cooperation between government, disabled people's organisations and groups, such as the Trussell Trust, groups affiliated to care, disability and more. We have the experience, the knowledge, and there should be a working plan with all of us involved instead of just panic politics, as much as we call it.
What strategies have Disability Rights UK played on raising awareness of such dramatic move in reducing welfare state even more?
Disability Rights UK has been pushing back on this with regular meetings with Stephen Timms, Minister for Disability. We are arranging a mass lobby event this month where, you know, a mass lobby is where a group arranges a large number of meetings between constituents and MPs for some time. This is an opportunity to push MPs to vote against these cuts, to show the strength of support and to take up visible space in Parliament. We're also collaborating on campaigns with Amnesty. We've been talking to the Trussell Trust and wider groups like our own Disability Poverty Campaign Group, which has members as wide as Scope, Food Foundation, and more. On our website, there is a page where actions individuals can take. There are letter writing campaigns to MPs, not just from us, but Inclusion London, Amnesty, Trussell Trust, and more. We do not accept that to build a sustainable economic future, that you push the already marginalised into a humanitarian crisis, no matter what the government spin there is. This is humanely unacceptable and will be a stain on Labour's legacy, especially as Keir Starmer, when in opposition, called disability benefit cuts indefensible. The shock and solidarity to push back against these cuts is widespread. People do not want this. There are 27 Labour MPs who now say they will vote against green paper cuts. This is just not disability anger. This is public anger. This is MP anger. You can see no benefit in this course of cruelty. They need to provide safety nets, invest, so we have a fully functioning health and social care system first, so that support is accessible and there when needed. We have the lowest benefits in Europe. We have to pay better benefits, invest in workplace adjustments, and the government needs to be talking to us if they're going to implement any change.
Thank you for your insight. Let me now get Glyn Robbins from LSE into this conversation. You have not only heard about food banks and communities with disability being affected, Glyn, there are other issues too. The days of affordable and safe homes are also gone in south of England. Is that right from your experience?
Well, I'm now a senior lecturer at London Metropolitan University, and I'm also the secretary of Tower Hamlets Trades Council. And incidentally, we will be joining the national lobby on the 21st of May. So I'll see you there, Dan, I hope, and you haven't. I wouldn't entirely agree with that proposition, Ripple. And I think we do still have a supply of genuinely affordable, secure housing, particularly in London and the South East, and it goes by the name of council housing. And it's really the erosion of council housing for the last four decades or so that I think has contributed to what I think is the key, or at least one of the key issues here, which is that housing has now become the main driver of poverty in this country. And you can look at a whole range of statistics to evidence that. I suppose the most obvious one of which is that rents have risen 7% in the private rented sector in the last year, not coincidentally, I think the number of people facing Section 21 evictions in the last year has also gone up by 7%. So I think there's a clear overlap there. And you look across a whole range of indicators, and I look at this stuff all the time and have done for many years, but even I was somewhat shocked to see a report last week saying that England now has, it by a whole different set of metrics, the worst housing conditions in the whole of the developed world. And this hasn't happened overnight. You know, we have been seeing this movement towards a more privatized and commodified housing system in this country happening over successive governments. But I mean, we're now reaching a critical point, really. And for all the reasons that Helen and Dan have outlined, we really have to say enough. We have to change our whole approach, not just to housing, but understand how housing impacts on people's lives in numerous ways, which again, Helen and Dan have talked about. So it's not that we don't have some housing that is there to meet people's needs rather than to make money from. And I, going back to what you were asking, Helen, I think it was, you know, I do remember a time when, I wouldn't say there weren't housing problems, but they were on nowhere near the scale that we have now. You know, I've worked in the field long enough to be able to say there was a time in my lifetime, in my working lifetime, when there were problems, but they were on nowhere near this scale. So we really have reached a point where we have to say we must change.
How do we get to this stage?
How did we get to it? Well, I mean, most housing academics, which I suppose I am in some respects, will point to 1980 as year zero, because that's when the right to buy was introduced by the Thatcher government and enabled council tenants to have a legal right to buy their homes. Now, that is certainly an important issue. It's led to the loss of around 1.2 million council homes. And again, there's a kind of similarity in numbers there, because there's about 1.2 million households that are currently on housing waiting lists. So clearly one has contributed to the other. But I think it's a mistake to only see this issue through the prism of the right to buy. We've actually had more homes lost through to social renting homes lost through various forms of privatisation over the last two decades or so. Council housing being transferred to essentially private landlords. I mean, they like to call themselves social landlords and housing associations, but actually that's not legally correct. They're private landlords and often resembling private developers, and housing associations have received large amounts of public money. And unfortunately, and I say that genuinely, I used to work for one, have not been building the homes we need. Far more of their homes are now being built for the private market in some form or another than are being built for social renting. So we have a real problem when it comes to housing policy that has essentially been based on privatisation and commodification. And of course, we've also seen, again, something that's happened in my lifetime, really, but I'd say a kind of deification of home ownership, that essentially, and I think this fits with what Dan was saying, actually, you know, a sense that you're not really a full citizen unless you've got a mortgage. I mean, whether or not you can afford it is a secondary question, but, you know, that really to have full entitlement as a human being almost. And I think, again, the stigmatisation of people with disabilities and people in poverty links to this. You have to have a fully paid up mortgage by the time you're 60. Well, you know, I'm one of the people who has been able to do that, but I don't think that makes me a better person. And I don't think our society and our economy should be driven by that kind of ideology. And I think, just finally, I think on the point of ideology, I think we really need to remember that a lot of what we've been discussing so far is based on an ideological attack on poor, marginalized people and people of color and people with disabilities. And this is partly pandering to the far right. And this threat is very, very important. The way, well, we saw evidence of it last Thursday, the way that the far right, and what I'm thinking about is Reform UK, but other more violent forces as well, are exploiting the need that we're talking about to scapegoat minorities. And this is very, very dangerous, and we have to unite to oppose it. And just finally, I think none of us have mentioned it, but we have to remember that a large amount of the money that the government is saying It wants to save through the disability cuts, and it won't end with people with disability, incidentally. They're the thin end of what will be a very thick wedge. But the government are proposing to spend that money on weapons of war. You know, someone said, we lobbied our local MP, Roshana Ali, a few weeks ago, and somebody spoke outside. Well, she wasn't there, incidentally, which is another issue. But we were outside her office, and somebody said, this government is cutting the benefits of people with disability to spend money on bombs that will create more disabled people in Gaza. And I thought that really summed up the state that we are in.
Glenn, do you see a shift in asking the state for help and moving away from asking for help from the state?
I think we have to move away from the sense that the state is giving us anything. We pay for this. We pay for these services through our taxation. It's intergenerational. I benefit directly or indirectly from the 50 plus years of tax that my parents paid. And I'm doing the same now for my children and grandchildren. We want a society that is reciprocal, that does respect people regardless of their physical or psychological condition. We want an inclusive society. I mean, that kind of language is used very loosely these days and rhetorically, but actually, and again, I don't want to paint a kind of black and white nostalgia here, but you know, the principles of the welfare state that Dan alluded to are ones that I think stand the test of time. And I think every single opinion poll that you look at says that most people in Britain do abide by those values, that we want a caring society. Now, it has to be paid for. But I don't think we should be, as it were, expecting the state to give us a handout. We demand that our government responds to people's needs, whatever those needs may be. We contribute to that expenditure through our taxation. We should be, incidentally, and another thing we haven't talked about, but when the question of, oh, there isn't enough money comes up, well, I say, well, the money is there anyway, already within the system in terms of the amount of money we waste. And if there's more money needed, then we need to tax the rich. There are more billionaires in this country post-COVID than there were before. Those people need to be making a far bigger contribution to meeting the needs of our society. So, you know, I think it's really important that we don't get into a sense of impotence and hopelessness about this. You know, the campaigns that we are all involved in independently need to be joining together and saying we do not want this kind of model of society. We are not prepared to put up with this any longer because, as everyone else has said, it is getting worse. And I suppose I do begin to feel a little bit old when I think, well, you know, I didn't think it could get any worse. I really didn't. I you know, 10 years ago, I was saying, well, this is, as far as housing is concerned, this has got as bad as I thought it could get. And actually has got progressively worse in the 10 years since. And it will continue to get worse until we have politicians and a system of government that actually genuinely cares for people. Don't just talk about caring for people, but genuinely cares for people and has a much more social attitude to how we run things.
So speaking of running things, what action can we take to genuinely find a way to support communities and organise activities?
Well, I mean, I'm a trade unionist, and trade unions are still the largest civic organisations in this country. Around 7 million people are still trade unionists. Now, the labour movement has gone through some difficult times, and so, you know, I can understand why young people in particular don't look to the labour movement and the trade union movement. But actually, it's a source of mutual strength and solidarity. And so it shouldn't only be there when people are on strike, albeit that is, you know, in a way, that's the day job for trade unions, resolving disputes in the workplace. But I think increasingly, and certainly through my trade unions, we increasingly try and say, well, look, you know, workplace issues have now become home place issues because this link between poverty wages and having referred to this, you know, most, well, nearly half the people who now receive benefits in this country are working. Well, that is about inadequate wages, and trade unions have an important role to play in getting organised in the workplace and demanding better paying conditions. But I think we mustn't leave it at the workplace. We need to be fighting on all fronts, if I can put it that way. We need to be uniting campaigns, and we need to be, you know, when we go next, well, it's May the 21st, You know, we need to be saying very clearly to our members of parliament in Tauhamlets and everywhere else, listen, if you are prepared to drive at least 250,000, if not 500,000 more people into poverty, do not expect that we are going to vote for you at the next election. You know, you no longer represent us. If you're going to do things like that, if you're prepared to spend money on weapons instead of welfare, then we are no longer going to support you. We will not vote for you. We will find other people to represent us. So, you know, that's a big statement. And I don't think it's only about elections. Actually, I think what we do in between is important as well. And Deepak, we had a public meeting last week in Bethnal Green around the cuts with Deepak, which I'm sure is an organisation that Dan knows, disabled people against cuts. And, you know, they're quite front foot, if I can put it that way, and they will engage in civil disobedience around some of this. And I think as far as housing is concerned, you know, I'm amazed in some ways that we don't see more squatters, albeit that it's been criminalised. But I think, we can't wait. We cannot wait for the election cycles. That's what politicians do. We cannot wait. You know, people are suffering and dying every day because of the conditions that this government and others are creating, and we need to be getting organised and agreeing that we insist on better.
Thank you, Glenn. For those who are listening to Debt Talk Podcast and want to share your stories or expertise, you can get in touch with me, ripon@debttalk.org. Let me go back to my panel members as campaigners. What tips, and I know many of you have already covered it, what tips would you give to organise campaign on food poverty and welfare rights issues within the context of the current government? Let me start with Helen Barnard from Trestle Trust.
So I think probably a couple of things. One is to be very clear about what the drivers are and what actually needs to be fixed. So talking about people having enough income to meet their essential needs with dignity is really important, to make sure that we don't kind of go down a side alley of how do we kind of get more food to people. We want people to have the dignity of being able to go out to shops and buy their own food like everyone else. I think the other thing I would say is, just from a kind of campaigning point of view, I think for a lot of campaigners, the kind of language and arguments that feel most strongest to us when we are immersed in an issue are not always the kinds of language and arguments that will persuade people who are not already on side for a given campaign. So one of the things over the last decade or so, I've done a lot of work around understanding how the wider public think about poverty, what kind of arguments actually work with them and what don't. And quite often, the things that I would instinctively think are strongest turn out to be either not particularly effective or, in fact, counterproductive. So actually listening to what people who don't already agree with you think and finding ways to speak to them where they are is really important. Otherwise, I think we can find we're kind of all talking to each other and we're all already on board with the changes. So having a kind of big tent approach, reaching out beyond your natural allies, the usual suspects, I think is really vital to build a broad-based movement that will achieve change, but also will help us hold on to change. Because what we need is the public, the broad swathe of the public, to be bought into the idea that social security should be sufficient to protect people from hunger and hardship, so that as you go through different governments, that is retained. We need people to feel about social security the way they feel about the NHS. And that's going to be a long-term endeavour, but it has to be a big tent, reach out beyond people who already agree if it's going to succeed.
Thank you, Helen. And Dan from Disability Rights UK.
I would absolutely agree with Helen on that. I mean, as much as we can discuss with other disabled organisations and groups, such as the Trussell Trust and Amnesty and stuff, we find ourselves within an echo chamber talking to ourselves who are all aware of the situation. Educating the wider public on this is absolutely essential. We need to educate the wider public on what social security is. And the fact is, it is available to everyone. One statistic that I'm always coming back to is the fact that at some point in your life, everyone will be disabled to some degree, whether it be temporarily or on a permanent basis. We need to make people aware of the system is there to support people. This could happen to anyone at any time, and it should be there to support those people, all people, every single person. Another aspect that says visiting your local MP, get to know your local MP, voice your disapproval to your local MP. Letter writing campaigns such as the Trussell Trust, such as R, such as Inclusion London, get those letters sent out, signed and shared. Get them sent out to other organisations that maybe are not disability related. But I would absolutely agree with Helen. We need to engage the wider population on this, to let them understand what's going on, rather than this tabloid media narrative, which unfortunately seems to be leading the charge on this.
Thank you, Dan. And finally, Glyn Robbins from Metropolitan University.
And Tam, it's Tracy Council. I mean, I suppose, boringly, might just have to echo what Helen and Dan said. But, you know, I think there is an important work within the labour movement. And I feel that it's one that, thinking of what Helen said, that actually transcends the labour movement. And that word is solidarity. And obviously that can mean a lot of things to different people. But I think, you know, in working class communities, there is a natural sense of solidarity across a whole range of issues. And that has been a kind of slogan for the labour movement. But I think we need to move beyond it being a slogan and actually say, well, what does this mean, this word solidarity? We're looking out for each other. We're caring for each other. We're aware, as Dana says, of the fact that this could happen to any of us. You know, any of us, we're one paycheck away from homelessness or a food bank visit, or, you know, one accident away from needing to claim PIP. This could happen to any of us. So I think this, the word solidarity means a lot to me personally, means a lot to the labour movement, but I think it means a lot in our society, actually. And I don't buy into the negative stereotype that we are encouraged to think of as individuals in society increasingly. And I think, albeit that that's what governments and media and propaganda outlets of various kinds want us to do, I don't think most people do that. I think most people are concerned about their neighbour. And I think it's our job to try and articulate that in a political fashion and to demand better.
Thank you, Glyn. I would like to thank Glyn, Dan and Helen for taking part and giving their time out of their busy schedule. Without your input, Debt Talk would not have reached this far. Because of your contribution, I can confirm that the Debt Talk has the highest ratings and comments in the UK on the debt subject on Spotify. So in the next podcast, I'm going to explore innovation in the debt sector. Thank you for listening to Debt Talk podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray.